Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did America get so addicted to energy? And what's likely to happen to us as the substances that heat our homes, propel our vehicles, and keep our lights on start to run out? Environmental journalist Amanda Little has been writing about our use of natural resources throughout her career, but even she was taken by surprise in 2007 when she undertook a cross-country journey to understand the relationship between American energy and American power. Her new book about the experience is called Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. Amanda, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So we get the real sense reading this book that the energy addiction that threatens our power is also what gave us this power. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing that as far back as World War I, you know, the outcome of power struggles was determined by access to energy. The use of oil is often credited in World War One as what made the British Navy more nimble and faster than the opponents, and eventually led the Allies to victory. Then World War Two was an oil-powered war. It was the first sort of man versus machine war, and it was after that in 1945 that President Roosevelt met with King Ibn Saud and sort of set the table for a relationship with the Middle East where we would offer military support in exchange for privileged access to fuel. So, again, it was understood very clearly that power, that access to cheap and abundant energy would impart political power, that literally, you know, in the field of battle, you had an upper hand with unlimited supplies to energy, and in the world of diplomacy, you had power when you were in control of the flow of oil.
And notably, in World War One, that was sort of the beginning of government subsidies and incentives for the energy industry.
Actually, that's true. That's true. And World War II, they only increased. So, yes, the idea, it was clear that, and it's amazing to kind of put that into perspective, the United States was the Saudi Arabia of oil during that time. I mean, in the teens and the 20s, up through the 70s, actually, we were, enormously rich in our production and distribution of fuel. The fuel that was coming, the resources that were coming out of your territory right there in Texas, in Beaumont, Texas. I described the Spindletop Gusher in 1901 that basically unleashed the petroleum age in the United States, hugely pivotal. And that very oil that was being harvested and distributed around the world was actually going in, was actually being used in the battlefield. We were mobilizing our own oil industry as part of the strategy of war.
It's amazing to read that within a year after Spindletop, we were, as you say, exporting oil to places that included Mexico.
Yeah, the story of Spindletop is one of my favorite in the book, and what's amazing is that at the time, and it's so hard to keep this in perspective, but at the time, the Rockefeller Empire, which was actually built in the late 1800s, really, oil was used as kerosene, as a lighting fuel. It wasn't used for what it is today, which is transportation, movement, and largely what we're all used to associating with oil is our cars, our aircrafts, our ships. This extraordinary system of transportation that's just constantly buzzing around the world. But initially Rockefeller made his zillions of dollars off of just what he said, offering light to the darkest corners of the world. So he was shipping oil to and distributing oil to regions of the world that had never had, you know, constant source of light. And then that was displaced, of course, very soon thereafter, in the early 1900s, by the invention of the light bulb. So what's amazing is that what saved the oil industry, really, was this discovery, thanks largely to Spindletop and Beaumont, that oil could was a great transportation fuel.
Yeah, it is an interesting reminder that we had the fuel first and then sort of backfilled all these technologies that would use it.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, the initial thought was this is great. It offers a steady, pure light, and, and no wonder. I mean, the Rockefeller's lighting fuel was very, very successful. It was only, a kind of an afterthought. And it was actually because the fuel, the grade of the fuel that was discovered, or the crude, rather, that was discovered in Beaumont and Spindletop, it was actually a lower grade fuel, and it wasn't good for lighting and for refining into kerosene. It was very good for transportation fuel.
You spent some time aboard an offshore drilling rig. Can you talk about what you learned about the operation that surprised you?
Yeah, I was surprised to find myself impressed and dazzled by the ingenuity of the oil industry, which I had spent many years criticizing. And by the way, that's kind of a theme throughout the book, that, you know, I had spent so many years criticizing, the government's energy and environmental policies, only to realize that I was as much to blame for America's energy addiction as everyone else. And I was as dependent on these fuels, and I benefited from them as much as, as everyone else. And no matter what car I drive, or what decisions I make in my life, still virtually everything in my midst is connected to fossil fuels and their byproducts. So that was a very humbling moment, and also so important to me to kind of put my politics aside and to really look at the benefits of a system that is changing so dramatically. So the exercise of going to this deep-sea oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico with some executives from Chevron was just that, was to look at, what are the extremes that we're going to get this stuff? And backing up, the story of Jed Clampett and the Beverly Hillbillies is, this great American sort of legend that, you could accidentally, remember, Jed Clampett's bullet was intended for his dinner, and it accidentally hit this
black gold.
Black gold, right. Exactly. And up, comes a gusher of oil, and he becomes an instant millionaire. And same thing with Jet Rink. Remember, in Giant, he sort of accidentally, this, hapless ranch hand, accidentally steps in this oil seep in this little corner of this land that he was that he owned, and up, and he, in his footprint pools this black gold. And again, it's this idea that, oil was the source of instant riches. It was the American dream, and it was this idea that we could instantly propel ourselves forward to great, heights of wealth and power by these sort of accidental riches buried in the soil of our nation. So now, fast forward to 2007, and here I am, 200 miles off the coast of Louisiana, and these engineers are guiding a drill 30,000 feet below sea level in 7,500 feet of water on this floating raft with giant engines attached to each corner of the raft, and they're pushing and pulling against this churning ocean to keep the rig on station so that the drill can make it down, 5 miles into the earth. And it's an amazing contrast, this idea that once, Jed Clampett could, accidentally unleash a gusher, and now we have to go to these extraordinary lengths to get this stuff. So that was the idea there. But what I kind of went into this experience thinking I'm going to just be appalled that we're, this is so absurd. Why are we doing this? Why not put that money toward, these new alternatives? And instead, I found myself realizing that this is yet another example of extraordinary ingenuity. you know, it was ingenuity that built our cities, our military, our industries, and found ways to use these diverse applications for oil and natural gas. Now ingenuity is enabling us to go to greater and greater lengths to get this, you know, to get these resources. And it will be ingenuity that develops the alternatives and moves us into a new era of energy. But to me, to start the book out in this, you know, in this extraordinary, extreme circumstance, and find myself as impressed and excited and inspired by what was happening as I was kind of concerned, it was an important perspective shift for me.
Yeah. Did your thoughts on drill, baby, drill change?
Yes. My thoughts, you know, are certainly that there's a very kind of a desperate sort of addict, you know, persona that we have, you know, that's kind of represented in that line, drill, baby, drill, this idea that we're going to continue drilling ourselves to freedom or drilling ourselves into these, you know, ever greater reaches of the earth where the oil is. And it simply it fails to see the reality that, you know, our oil resources in this nation have been declining rapidly since 1970. And, you know, there are greater and greater risks and costs for this drilling, these drilling exercises. And even if we do open up, you know, these reserves in Anwar or on the outer continental shelf, and, you know, these areas that drilling advocates are saying, let's go there. Even if we do that, we're not going to buy ourselves more than, you know, another decade of resources. So, yes, I think there's a very concerning sort of implausible and or absurd, you know, approach to this or faith in just drilling alone. But I'm not opposed to more drilling, and I'm not opposed to opening up more drilling territory as long as we're also doing applying the same kind of focus and resources and ingenuity to efficiency and alternatives.
You know, another element of petroleum use that is easier to forget sometimes is that we use it to make plastic. And you write here, this is amazing, but I think it's true, most of us have more contact with plastics every day than we have with human skin.
Yeah, and I'm glad you raised that. It's actually the first time I've heard someone bring that up. And it's true, you know, the story of energy is so much more sort of diverse and miraculous than, you know, just the question of what we use in our cars. And that's important because oil is largely used for movement. However, the most important applications of oil are to make these very sophisticated petrochemicals that in turn go into the production of plastics, the production of medicines like acetaminophen, which is the pain-killing ingredient in Tylenol, or even chemotherapies, penicillins, and so on, and even, you know, fertilizers and pesticides and you know the ingredients in our you know used in our agricultural industry. So the applications for oil and natural gas you know are far more various and diverse than we often notice. So the plastics chapter actually opens up in a scene where I'm observing a breast implant.
Let me stop you right there because we need to take a quick break, and it's a very interesting story. Amanda Little is with us. She's an environmental journalist whose new book is called Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is environmental journalist Amanda Little. Her new book is called Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You let us know before the break, Amanda, that you're going to talk about your visit to a plastic surgeon's office, in part inspired by a friend of yours who'd had a mastectomy and a breast reconstruction.
Yes, exactly. What was fascinating to me, and you said that you were amazed to read that, you know, we probably touch more plastic objects than we do human skin. And again, these plastic objects are petroleum byproducts. But just look around you. I mean, what's amazing, and right now I'm sitting at my desk, and everything I see, the varnish on my desk, the plastic keyboard, the phone receiver that I'm holding, even the gloss on my magazine, the paints on my walls, the ink in my pen, all that comes from petroleum-derived products, from petrochemicals. And so that's interesting in and of itself, but it's even more amazing to me that we can even implant these products in our bodies. And my friend, when she had her breast reconstruction, did this kind of high-tech breast implant, this new kind of silicone, which is called cohesive silicone. It's actually in Nip and Tuck Argo. It's gummy bear breast implants. And that means that it's not a liquid in there. It's kind of this, it feels like a jello kind of. And she got this warranty that was, you know, it's like a 100-year warranty on her breast.
May she live so long.
Right. She said, my breast will outlive my body. you know, isn't it amazing that it can cohabitate, it can live very comfortably inside our bodies, but it's this foreign substance that was, you know, derived from this stuff that we give a bad name, you know, oil, this bad thing. But in fact, in my friend's life, it's very important. And in fact, I should say it's natural gas in this case. Natural gas often is used to make the petrochemicals in petroleum. But anyway, very similar substance. And the alchemy, I mean, the amazing story here is that the same substance that is used to, you know, fuel an F-16 fighter jet can also be used to make, you know, a breast implant. So I wanted to kind of see that up close and personal. So that's, you know, throughout the book, I go to NASCAR tracks and Kansas cornfields and inside the Pentagon and crawl inside the New York City electricity grid. And, you know, the book is a series of adventures where I kind of go and try to experience this frontier of energy, this different application of energy. So in this case, I and saw an actual gummy bear breast implant, it was miraculous to see that this, you know, that in a matter of 20 minutes flat, you know, they could pop in this state-of-the-art silicone object and, you know, sew up the patient, and that was it. It was pretty seamless and in a manner of speaking. But it was, again, a humbling and, I think, important experience for me as a longtime critic of these industries, these fossil fuel industries, to say, you know, there are so many benefits that, and, you know, my father-in-law had a pacemaker, my mother-in-law has artificial hips, all these, you know, are medical devices that use plastics. And so, again, before we identify the problems with our energy landscape, before we look at our abuse of fossil fuels, we have to look at our use of them. And once we understand how important they are in our lives and how much we benefit, then it's going to be easier to kind of say, okay, now our energy system is changing. There are all these unintended consequences. There are environmental costs, there are political costs, and there are economic costs. These, you know, these substances are very volatile. They're becoming more and more expensive, and their markets are volatile. So let's look at the next energy frontier, the next energy, you know, the revolution in clean and sustainable energy, as a very crucial part of our cultural evolution. You know, energy has defined who we are as a nation. And, you know, and now it's going, and the new energy industry is also going to redefine who we are as a nation.
And there's a great deal of irony here as well in even the automotive industry. Of course, we're all concerned about how much fossil fuel we're consuming in our cars. But you write about the fact that plastic panels are making a lot of cars much lighter, much more fuel efficient. So from petroleum, you create this product that allows you to use less petroleum.
Yes, that is a great irony. True. I mean, some of the most important advances in lightweight auto bodies, you're right, the alternatives to steel and very heavy auto parts are very sophisticated plastics. And I think that, it's important to recognize that there are very, very beneficial applications of oil. And the challenge is not so much going cold turkey on fossil fuels, but using them in their best, highest applications. Burning oil in a gas tank is like burning a 14th century antique in a campfire. It's just not the best application of that, you know, beautiful antique. Whereas, you know, when you use this very molecularly complex and this rich substance to, you know, create sophisticated plastic for future cars. That, I think, is, you know, a wonderful application. So when we talk about the end of oil or the end of fossil fuels, I think it's misleading. It's really, how are we going to use them more wisely and more efficiently?
Yeah. Another thing that you write about that I thought was really interesting was that after you and your husband bought a Prius, you sort of stopped and realized that the money you had invested, I don't know, $24,000, $25,000, might in fact have been better spent retrofitting your house to make that a more efficient machine.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's true. I think energy efficiency is probably the least exciting, you know, topic for anyone to discuss because it just means using less of something. And so, you know, how excited can you get around about that? And, you know, there have been fancy terms that people have come up with. Negawatts is one of them. How can we kind of negate our energy use? But still, it just doesn't fly. You know, you don't, you know, when people say, what's the number one thing we need to do? And, you know, the answer really is we need to become more efficient. And I was a victim of that. I kind of said, "Well, it's much more exciting in my life to have a Prius in my driveway than it is to do all these kind of behind the scenes things like, seal up the cracks in my house and put in energy efficient windows and wrap the boiler and do all that. It doesn't sort of demonstrate an effort to lighten the footprint." But probably the money I save in gasoline with a fuel-efficient car doesn't compare to the money I would save in my energy bills in my home from, you know, these measures, these energy efficiency measures on homes. But it's low-hanging fruit, and a lot of the focus now with, for instance, stimulus dollars is going toward just that, toward weatherizing homes. How can we... And green mortgages are now available. Some banks are offering mortgages that enable people to make investments up front in some of these measures and, you know, super efficient appliances, well-insulated walls and windows, even, you know, rooftop solar panels and what they're calling zero energy homes, this idea that your home could, over the course of a year, produce as much energy as it consumes and feed that energy when it's not in use back into the grid. These concepts are very exciting, but the actual effort to just, you know, make your house more efficient doesn't get a lot of play.
Well, and in your defense, and you mentioned these green mortgages, but it's a lot easier to get a loan for a Prius, you can do that in 15 minutes, than it is to convince the bank to give you an equal amount of money to retrofit your house.
It's true. And, you know, my bank in Nashville, Tennessee, which is where I live, wasn't offering green mortgages. That's a very, or EEMs, energy efficiency mortgages. It's a very new concept, and it's one that's actually getting a lot of traction. But it's an emerging idea, whereas, you know, just financing a car is an old and proven concept that they've been doing since, you know, the 1950s. tens and 20s.
So aside, Amanda, from personal energy consumption, there is defense energy consumption, which is something that we ought to all be very much aware of right now. I was amazed to read about the energy requirements of that F-16 that you mentioned earlier in the hour for a single hour.
Yeah. Yeah, an F-16 uses in the course of a single hour the amount of energy, the fuel equivalent, I should say, the amount of energy that an average American family uses over the course of a year. Hmm. The important distinction there is that F-16s, of course, use jet fuel, and family homes use natural gas and oil and electricity and all different kinds of fuel, but that measurement is the energy equivalent of what's used by a jet engine in 1 hour versus family use. So it does compare, because there are a lot of energy geeks out there who will say, how can you make that comparison? It's an amazing thing, and I talked to fuel logistics officials at the Pentagon who walked me through the challenges that they have in fueling the battles of Iraq every day, and they said that in a single day in Iraq, 1.5 million gallons of fuel must be distributed. 1.5 million gallons of fuel is burned a day in the battlefield of Iraq, and that that means that these fuel convoys are rumbling through the back roads of the country at all hours of the day in these armored vehicles delivering the fuel, because they can't use pipelines. The pipelines are vulnerable to attack and interruption, so they have to security details put incredible investments of human resources and financial resources in getting the fuel to the point of use. So not only is it of the volume of fuel that's amazing, but it's the cost of that fuel.
And this is something that the Department of Defense is not only completely aware of, but trying to do something about. They've got some green energy plans in the works.
Yes. It's exciting to think that the Pentagon, which was responsible for the development of the internet and GPS and helicopters and so many other major technological breakthroughs, it's exciting to think that they are putting their best minds on the question of how can we bring energy independence to the battlefield. There was a priority memo from a major general in Iraq a couple of years ago, and it said, urgent, we need clean, renewable, independent energy resources to protect our soldiers, because the more fuel we need to bring to our barracks, the more vulnerable our troops are that have to go and secure those resources and secure those fuel convoys. So he actually said, this is a matter of strategic urgency. We need to save lives by having fuel cells and solar panels and windmills that will ease our energy burdens out here. Because, of course, those bases out in, in any military base is running off of diesel fuel. So, an air conditioner has to run off of fuel that's delivered by a convoy. Likewise, communications, crucial, survival tools are depending on the fuels that run them. So he's saying, yes, let's put our minds on it. And the Pentagon took me through, amazing innovations that they're doing in efficient living pods and these efficient tents.
They're insulating these tents.
Yeah, they're just doing, in this case, it's a matter of, it's really simple stuff where they're just spraying, a huge layer of foam inside the tents, and eventually those tents will have, a kind of film of solar producing, these thin film solar panels that will kind of wrap around the tents and make the tents independent, energy-independent living pods. But they're also doing hybrid engine tanks. They're coming up with, algae fuels for jet engines, or this is a big area of innovation. They're trying to develop much, much more efficient jet engines. It runs the gamut. They're doing wearable solar for military uniforms so that they can actually have energy-producing capabilities in their clothing, so they don't have to carry around huge battery packs. It's amazing what's happening, and it's very inspiring.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Amanda Little, whose new book is called Power Trip. Let's go first to Kent in Cedar Hill. Hello, Kent.
Hi. I was wondering if her book touches on the fact of how many people have to die to support our thirst for oil, not only in wars, but in the great expense that she talked about of our war machine burning the fuel. We have to pay that back in taxes, and people die in their occupations just trying to earn enough money to get by. And I was wondering if the book spoke to that, and the things like the Exxon Valdez, where they paid no fine whatsoever for totally polluting a corner of our earth.
Amanda?
That's a great question and a very important one. I don't actually have, a number associated with that. I do, the book does take a very serious look at the cost of using fuel. Certainly, the cost of human life in the battlefield. I describe at length, ambushes on fuel convoys and the lives of soldiers that were lost in defending those convoys. I haven't looked at the, I don't even know if it's been calculated, how many people have died from paying taxes on fuel. But it's an important question, and I think that's speaking to the bigger issue that, there are extraordinary benefits of this energy system and extraordinary costs, and the costs are so hidden. The political costs and the environmental costs, and they need to be exposed.
Amanda Little is my guest. She's an environmental journalist whose new book is called Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is environmental journalist Amanda Little. Her new book is called Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to switch gears here a little bit, Amanda, and talk about the time that you spent with Boone Pickens.
I was finally invited aboard his private jet, midway through my power trip adventure, and which was a great honor for me because I've perceived Boone Pickens as kind of the personification of America. Sort of where Boone goes, so goes America. And if this great, the great wildcatter of the 20th century can have a sort of enlightenment moment where he sees, and not only does he see, but also heavily invests in this new future in clean, sustainable energy, then I'd say the rest of America can kind of figure that out too. And he has since launched his Pickens Plan. It was right after, actually, I met with him. But the story of our meeting was this. I accompanied him to a meeting in Pampa, Texas, where, as you know, he envisioned this gigantic wind farm, and he has since had to kind of split that plan up into many smaller projects, partly because of funding challenges and also because of the logistical and financial challenges of putting a giant transmission line that would pipe the energy from this big wind farm to the places of use. But what I learned on the trip, even without, you know, given the hurdles that his project is facing, was very important. And it was I think, well defined by this one quote that he said to a rancher in Pampa, Texas, who was kind of asking him what the benefits are of wind power over oil, which is what what Mr. Pickens knows so well. And he said, well, look, imagine that you have a wind turbine on your land that does about $20,000 a year. It produces about $20,000 of electricity a year. That's just blades on a post. It's really simple machinery, easy maintenance, but it blows out there for maybe a century because it's, it's pretty hardy machinery. And over time, it generates $2 million for your family if you're hosting that turbine. So it's a totally different scenario than an oil well that produces for a few years and then it's done for. And so to hear him kind of spell that out to this community and say, here are the benefits of this technology. It's not about trying to sell it as, oh, it's green, it's going to solve climate change, or it's going to. Even in this case, he wasn't even talking about the political benefits, which is one of his motivators. You know, he's very emphatic about getting off of Middle Eastern oil and the challenges that poses from a diplomacy standpoint. He doesn't like the vulnerability that comes from our dependence on Middle Eastern oil. But in this case, it was a purely economic argument. He was saying, look, this has economic benefits that are far better than those nodding donkey derricks that we've seen, all over Texas for, 100 years. These things won't dry up. They're gonna keep producing year after year, for more than a century. So that was a turning point for me in the writing of this book. And by the way, he was also very gracious. And and I knew that he was going to be an imposing and sort of intimidating character, but he was very kind and kind of grandfatherly to me, so I had a nice time.
Of course, one of the problems we know is that even here in Texas, there are days when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. How are we doing in terms of creating technology to store that energy once we've pulled it in?
You've put your finger on, I think, the most important issue. Two, in fact. One is storage, energy storage, and another is the grid technology. And in the case of, Mr. Pickens' wind farm fantasy, it was really hinging on the grid and on the electricity grid and how we're going to be able to pipe the electricity from the areas where the wind resources and the solar resources are most abundant to the population centers. In the case of wind, there are very steady wind resources, and we have tons and tons of data on, which parts of the country have the most reliable wind. But the problem is that they're pretty far removed from population centers. So, number one, we have to tackle the grid and the challenges of finding efficient ways to get the electricity from where the wind blows and where the sun shines. And in the case of the wind, it's usually in the central quarter of the country, and the steadiest supply of sunshine is really in the southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, et cetera. How do we get that to the point of use? So that's one challenge. The other challenge is, as you say, intermittency. We have sun only shining, of course, in the daytime and when there are no clouds, and the wind only blowing, when the wind decides to blow. So I think that, if there's two areas of technological innovation that we need to be focusing on and putting our resources right now, it's on how to rebuild the grid, the electricity grid, how to build what they call a super grid or a smart grid that's going to be much more dynamic and and capable of incorporating all these new kinds of electricity and powering electric cars, which is another very important shift and innovation, and then also battery storage. So we're seeing development in both of those areas, but again, it's kind of like energy efficiency. It's not where most of the focus of the conversation is right now, because batteries and grid and efficiency are not the most exciting things to discuss, but they are the most important technologies on the horizon.
How much of the $70 billion that Congress allocated earlier this year for clean energy spending goes to those not very exciting but very essential points of development?
It's a great question. There has been some, you know, I know that there are definitely significant investments, and I would say in the area of, I'm not looking at my statistics right now, but in the area of, I don't know, you know, 10, 15 billion is going to those areas. But I don't quote me on that. I'll can put that on my website. It's in the book. But the most important thing is that not enough is the answer. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now they're talking about, you know, a couple billion in rebuilding the grid. And the problem is that that's going to be a project that's cost tens and tens of billions of dollars. So, you know, advocates for grid and battery technology will say, you know, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface. You know, and it's a start. It's important that we're even moving in that direction. But it's so much hinges on these two areas of development. And you know, we can certainly, you know, in Europe and Japan, for instance, they have far more aggressive, you know, development of renewable energy than we do, and they don't have, you know, the grid technology and the battery technology that we're talking about. So we can certainly move ahead and start, you know, developing these industries and growing them. But it's important, you know, to be giving the priority to battery and grid technology that it deserves.
An email here, Amanda from Devon, asks if you would talk about what you think of the future of nuclear and coal energy and the environmental movement's opposition to any energy source that is not clean.
That's a great question. Nuclear is the kind of the elephant in the living room, and the you know, the promise on the one hand with nuclear is that it's carbon-free electricity production. On the other hand, it has tremendous challenges, and I would point out three major barriers to developing nuclear. One is political. We don't have a disposal and storage system for nuclear. There's been a proposal that we centrally store all the nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain in Nevada, but that has met, you know, political barriers. One of them is the fact that Harry Reid is from Nevada and he's the Senate Majority Leader, so he's kind of put the kibosh on that plan for the time being, and that could change. But still, you know, moving those political barriers will take many years. The second thing is that the construction time and the construction costs are enormous on nuclear. So even if we suddenly got this windfall of investment for nuclear, it would actually take, you know, 10 to 15 years to begin bringing these new plants online. So you have to get through the political barriers, then you have to get all the investment together, and then you have to build the things. So that's pretty far down the line. And then the third problem with nuclear is water. Nuclear plants require enormous amounts of water that are there to cool down the hot boiling water and create steam, which is how power plants work. And it's very hard to operate nuclear plants in areas that are vulnerable to drought. And drought, of course, is looming, you know, as a bigger and bigger reality on the horizon. So we often don't hear this, but I think that the water challenge with developing nuclear will be as serious of a barrier as the other two I mentioned. Coal is an important resource in the United States. You know, we're hugely well endowed with coal resources. The problem is that, you know, the term clean coal, which gets batted around a lot, is kind of an oxymoron. We don't have a demonstration project, a working sort of commercial coal plant that uses this supposedly clean coal technology. And the concept is that you take coal and you apply pressure and heat and you turn it into a gas. And when it's in a gas form, you can take out the carbon dioxide and then burn the rest of it. You can also take out other pollutants and then burn this sort of clean gasified coal. It hasn't been, and then you store the carbon dioxide underground. It hasn't been proven that we can really do this at a commercial scale, so that's the problem with that. However, I think it's important to pursue that technology, and I think there's many environmentalists or some that say it's very, very important to find cleaner ways to burn coal, and you know, while addressing the challenges that come with coal mining and mountaintop removal that have all kinds of environmental consequences. But what's astonishing is not so much what's happening in the U.S. with coal. And I know Texas, you have a lot of there's been a lot of protests and a lot of debate in your neck of the woods on adding new coal capacity in the state. So it's a big issue there. But in the rest of the world, China in the last 5 years has added as much coal capacity as we have in the entire U.S., which is one of the most shocking statistics I have in the book, I think. So whatever we decide to do in the U.S., whether we put a moratorium on coal, which many environmentalists say we need to do, or whether we, you know, start aggressively developing clean coal, it's going to continue, apace. It's going to continue very fast. The development of coal is going to be really picking up pace in China and India as those countries industrialize. So I think there's an argument for pushing cleaner and cleaner ways of burning coal, because even if we regulate it here, you know, it's got a future elsewhere.
I want to talk for a minute. You mentioned that as part of your research, you watched six straight seasons of the television show Dallas. And I just want to make sure that you know that we're not really like that.
I know. It was so hard for me to accept that South Fork, it really doesn't exist. In fact, I went
well,
to
Well, it does exist, but...
I know, but yeah. I mean, it doesn't exist. It exists as like a set, a stage. But I almost went, I have to tell you, because I became just such a devout fan of the Dallas soap opera series. And my husband, we being a, you know, very supportive husband and book kind of researcher ally, watched them all with me, so we had lots of fun there. But when we went to Fort Worth, you know, I said, "So when are we going to go to South Fork?" And he said, "Well, you know, I hate to break it to you, honey, but it's just a set, you know." So, but I do realize that, you know, Sue Ellen and Pamela and they weren't really alive.
The new book by environmental journalist Amanda Little is called Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. Amanda, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.